From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. A week after the UN's top officials said that there was no military solution to the war that's been raging in Syria since March of 2011, it appears the U.S. will be directly intervening in the conflict to try to achieve its long-standing goal of removing the Syrian government. President Barack Obama has reportedly authorized U.S. air support for Washington's so-called moderate opposition in Syria, despite recent reports that their numbers have thinned to the point of practical non-existence. Press TV's Waqar Rizvi has more.
U.S. officials say President Barack Obama has authorized the use of air power to back a newly trained militant force in Syria against other militant groups or Syrian government forces. The decision raises the risk of the U.S. military coming into direct conflict with the government of President Bashar al-Assad. The decision follows discussions between the U.S. and Turkey on creating a so-called safe zone along the Turkish-Syrian border. They are planning on sending militants they've trained into the zone as well as into other areas in northern Syria. The U.S. has already been carrying out airstrikes in Iraq and Syria against ISIL terrorists. But the attacks have repeatedly caused damage to these countries' infrastructure and targeted army forces and civilians. Well, to discuss that further, I joined Mr. Kevork Almasyan, who is an academic and political commentator, and he's joining us from Beirut. Now, Mr. Almasyan, how much of an escalation would this be in U.S. involvement in Syria?
The United States was already conducting airstrikes against ISIS and sometimes against Al-Nusra Front, who are considered terrorist organizations in Syria. But if President Barack Obama is planning to gain a major victory before the elections in order to serve its party for re-elections to become for the election of Democratic president in the future, he shouldn't carry out these attacks against the Syrian army, because the Syrian army is serving the strategy of fighting terrorism in the region. And the Syrian army is a major force that is able and has the capabilities to conduct major airstrikes and major blows against the terrorists. The United States declares that its first and foremost priority is to destroy and degrade the ISIS, the presence of ISIS in the northern part of Syria and other places. So by conducting airstrikes or attacking the Syrian army, you are giving a big service or on a golden plate to ISIS in these territories, where the Syrian army will withdraw and ISIS will fill the vacuum, or other terrorist organizations will also fill the vacuum.
But obviously, Mr. Almasyan, I would imagine the United States would argue that it wants to defeat both ISIL and the Syrian government. Will it be able to do both things at once?
I don't think that's a realistic option if we make the calculations on the ground, and if we think realistically of what's happening on the ground in Syria. We will see that you have major powers fighting on the ground. The Syrian army is one of the major powers, and this army is fighting ISIS and other terrorist organizations. So by defeating the Syrian army or President Bashar Assad, you are giving ground to ISIS, because at the current moment, the U.S. doesn't have the so-called moderate rebels on the ground. They are maybe tens, 50 or 60 moderate rebels, and these people cannot make any major advances underground in Syria. The Al-Nusra Front, the Islam's Army, the so-called Islamic State, or ISIL, these groups have the ground, these people have the power, these groups are enjoying the economic exports of oil. They are enjoying all the income of the oil exports into Turkey. So the United States first should deal with Turkey to stop the infiltration of the terrorists and stop the oil exchange between ISIS and Turkey, where ISIS is selling its oil to Turkey, and then to sit on a peace negotiation table with the Syrian government, with the Syrian army, because the Syrian army, whether the Americans liked it or not, it is the major force that is able to defeat terrorism in Syria.
And also, Mr. Almasyan, I'm wondering, you know, with the United States now set to get directly involved and even strike President Assad forces, if it so chooses, how will this affect the entire region? Because we know, of course, Syria is an important player in the region as well.
I think the escalation in Syria doesn't serve the interests of anybody in the region. Since the beginning of the crisis, the Syrian government and other players were warning, especially Iran, that the fire will spread into other regions. And now we can see that the fire already spread to Turkey, into the Gulf states, because of their reckless policies in Syria. Syria is in the heart of the Middle East, and by destroying the infrastructure and the backbone of the Syrian state, which is the Syrian army, you will give the ground for the terrorists who will not stop on the borders with Syria. These terrorists will conduct their operations in Jordan, in Iraq, in Turkey, and in other in Gulf states. This is a fact. But by the Americans, I cannot understand how the Americans are thinking at the current moment by attacking the Assad government or the Syrian army, because this will serve the interests of the terrorists, and these terrorists will carry out their operations against the allies of the United States. So the United States is adopting a contradicting policies. On one hand, it says it is fighting terrorism, but the other hand, they are fighting those who are fighting terrorism in Syria.
But despite the obvious contradiction between the policy of attacking Syria's armed forces and the reality that the Syrian army is the only effective force fighting ISIS and other terrorist groups in the region, the U.S. has maintained an almost singular purpose in its treatment of the conflict, as RT's Marina Dishashi reports.
Barack Obama has given authorization for U.S. planes to bomb Syria to help defend anti-government rebels. The new rules of engagement could even allow troops loyal to leader Bashar Assad to be directly targeted. Officially, the U.S. should only be protecting the fighters trained and armed by Washington against Islamic State. However, America has never kept its attitude towards what it wants in Syria secret.
The regime of Bashar al-Assad must come to an end.
Assad has to go.
It's time for Assad to get out of the way.
It is time for Bashar to go.
Washington has a long history of supporting what it brands a moderate Syrian opposition, but just over a month ago, a Pentagon chief admitted it was a struggle to find trustworthy recruits for U.S. programs.
We are trying to recruit and identify people that, as you put it, can be counted on to have the right mindset and ideology, not be aligned with groups like ISIL. It turns out to be very hard to identify people who meet both of those criteria.
Journalist and political commentator Ala Ibrahim believes U.S. jets could deprive Assad's troops of the last advantage they have over the rebels.
Many political analysts think that this could be a game changer if the United States of America puts its weight behind the rebels, even as they say now, a small rebel force that they have trained and vetted to fight ISIL. If they put this weight behind the rebels in their fight against the government of President Bashar al-Assad, that this could be very dangerous for the Syrian army, because the Syrian army, the main advantage it has over the rebels right now is having an air force, and once this advantage is neutralized, all odds are on the table, and militarily speaking, there will be little that the Syrian army has to offer in confronting these rebel groups, as the rebels are more capable of providing a higher number of fighters because of the ongoing influx of foreign fighters crossing in from Turkey into Syria to join in the fight against the Syrian government. This is a very tricky situation and a very complicated situation. Was ISIL affected by the coalition airstrikes against it across Iraq and Syria? Yes. Were the airstrikes decisive in diminishing ISIL capacities? No. ISIL up to this moment is capable of mobilizing troops and moving them along long ranges. Sometimes in the attack on Palmyra, they managed to move 1,800 fighters for over 200 kilometers undetected by the coalition satellites or the coalition air force. So as a result, ISIL lost some of its capabilities, but its capabilities were not drastically diminished. And we have to take into consideration that the main concern here is not the fact that the rebel force trained by the U.S. Against ISIL would make achievements using the protection of the coalition's air force. It is the interference of the coalition and the airstrikes of the coalition against government forces, against the forces of President Bashar al-Assad, which would make could turn the course of events in Syria. The rebel forces has not been able to achieve anything against ISIL in the past few months. Kurdish militias have made little gains against ISIL despite ongoing air coverage from the coalition led by the United States of America. So there's little for us, there's little that happened on the ground to make us believe that this would change the fight against ISIL and make the rebels effective or more effective in the face of ISIL. But if the new rules of engagement is applied to the fight between the government forces and the rebels, then it could be a game changer, because the government forces are up to a large extent dependent on their aerial superiority. The coalition led by the US depends on the Kurdish militias, for example, in northern Syria, to fight ISIL, and it provides aerial coverage for the Kurdish militias to bomb ISIL. Turkey has joined the alliance and it has carried airstrikes not only against ISIL but also against the Kurdish militias. So this is just an example of how complex the situation is.
The aim of the move is to push radicals away from the Turkish-Syrian border, establishing a so-called safe zone. In 2011, Western intervention in Libya also started with an aerial operation aimed at creating a no-fly zone.
Yes, many people fear that this could be the introduction of something much worse for the country, not maybe a no-fly zone, maybe dividing the country in a de facto way where the rebels would assume control of certain parts of the country with the air coverage of the coalition of Turkey, and then the Syrian government is unable to enter these areas, is unable to bomb these areas, and the country is divided and there's nothing that can be done about it because there is a certain balance of power. So the situation stands to be very, very dangerous. And again, if the new rules of engagement is applied against the Syrian government, against the Syrian army, then this could change the course of the war inside the country, obviously not in favor of the Syrian army.
An interesting development in the until now top secret investigation into the shooting down last July of Malaysian Airlines flight MH17. The Dutch agency heading the investigation contacted Russian news agency RT over the footage used in their recent documentary on the incident. The documentary, titled MH17, A Year Without Truth, showed fragments of the crashed Boeing and pieces of luggage still scattered in the area around Donetsk. The film crew collected parts of the plane's exterior they found and brought them to officials at the nearby town of Petropavlovsk. The film crew talked to witnesses, experts, and family members of flight MH17 passengers. Those family members said they've been unable to get information about the course of the investigation and questioned its objectivity. Dutch Safety Board spokesperson Sarah Vernuys reportedly wrote to RT, saying that they had watched the documentary with great interest, and that as to, quote, parts of the cockpit roof which were found near Petropavlivka, we would like to gather those pieces and bring them over to the Netherlands so the Dutch Safety Board can use them for the investigation and the reconstruction, closed quote. The mayor of Petropavlovsk, Natalia Voloshina, coordinated the collection of fragments in the region. She said that all of the parts of the wreckage found by locals have been placed in storage, some for a year, awaiting retrieval by the Dutch investigators. Meanwhile, the unrest in Ukraine continues. On Monday, a group of masked men attacked the offices of the Party of Regions in Kharkov, hurling firecrackers and rocks at the building. Wearing Ukrainian colors and sporting balaclavas, the men also damaged a minibus that reportedly belongs to the party. That followed an incident in Odessa over the weekend, where local police had to intervene to protect a group of family members holding a memorial for the 48 people who were burned alive there in a trade union hall by a right-wing mob in May of last year. The weekend vigil was attacked by a group of assailants who were ultimately turned back by police. Greece's stock market reopened Monday after being closed for the previous 5 weeks. The Greek market saw stocks plunge by more than 22% during the day, with shares of Greek banks being particularly hard hit, with a fall of about 30%. About 40 billion euros have been withdrawn from the bank's deposits over the past 6 months, and local traders still face transaction limits under the current capital control measures. The dramatic loss in value across the board was added confirmation of the government's claim, apparently shared by at least the IMF, that the country needs debt relief and not more austerity, as Dr. Stravos Mavrideas, professor of political economy at the University of Macedonia, told Press TV Monday.
As Greece is moving towards a third European Union austerity program, the prospects for the Greek economy are dire. It is already again in recession. For example, the manufacturing index in July has tumbled dramatically, because of the imposition of capital controls. And this was its seventh consecutive reduction. So the Greek economy is in shambles exactly because of the European Union austerity programs. The previous two European Union austerity programs have ruined the Greek economy. The new third program will lead it further downwards. The stock market, today's stock market crash, reflects this trend.
Prior to Monday's reopening, Greece's stock market had been shut down since a few hours before Athens announced a referendum on the bailout conditions of its international creditors in late June. The reopening occurred as the Greek government and its lenders prepared to open talks on a third bailout of about 86 billion euros. Moving to Latin America and the Caribbean region, there have been ongoing political battles in a number of countries there. In Ecuador, between the government and opposition protesters over an inheritance tax. In Brazil, between President Dilma Rousseff and a group of provincial governors. And in Bolivia and Chile, between those governments and mine workers. For all that and more, we spoke with our reporter from south of the border, Tony Solo, via Skype from Managua, Friday.
There's loads going on in the region. We were talking last week about the processes of dialogue that are going on in Ecuador, Brazil, and Bolivia,
right.
Dealing with the respective political problems thrown up by the opposition in those countries.
Yep, that's right.
And in Bolivia, that process seems to have had some success. The miners that had been in the capital of Bolivia, La Paz, for something over three weeks, seem to have gone back to Potosí, which is the area that was protesting, claiming that the government wasn't doing enough to develop that province of that department of Bolivia.
Right. They wanted a bigger share of the proceeds from the mines or something, right?
Yeah, and it looks as though the Bolivian government's claims that there were political manipulation behind that seem to have been borne out, because the social movements there in Potosí have convened a meeting to discuss the situation and to discuss the tactics used by the civic body that was promoting the strike. So, and it'll be interesting to see what the fallout is from that, because
that is interesting. That is interesting. It's like the people are with their own institutions are putting a leash on the, on the leadership that was tackling the government.
Yeah, and it's still a bit confused, but we'll see how that all pans out. And then over in Brazil, President Dilma Rousseff has been making quite energetic moves to engage the governors of the different provinces of Brazil, which we all know is a huge country, with its different states run by their own governors, and they have a lot of autonomy from one state to another.
Right.
And it looks as though Dilma Rousseff has made quite good progress negotiating a program of working together with the governors of the different states to help solve Brazil's economic problems, which have greatly affected Dilma Rousseff's popularity rating, and she's got one of the lowest popularity ratings in all of Latin America at the moment.
Right.
So then over in Ecuador, Rafael Correa and his team have been engaging in dialogue with various organizations and the trade union sector and the different social movements, social organizations, in a national discussion about the proposed inheritance tax and other changes to Ecuador's tax system, which the government argues will be more redistributive.
Right.
But the opposition in Ecuador is doing all they can to use that legislation against the government. And
well, that opposition has among it many of the people from whom the redistribution will be taken.
Right, quite. So there, and that's what's been going on in that area of the what we were talking about last week of the progressive governments, right, after a long period in office, then find that they get involved in a different kind of dynamic, trying to sustain the momentum of their progressive policies.
Right.
So that's going on. Then down in Chile, there's a copper workers' strike that's been going on for, I think, 12 days now. And that strike is by subcontractors to Codelco, Chile's nationalized copper organization. And of course, Chile is the world's main exporter of copper, and their main customer, China, seems to be experiencing some kind of slowdown, so that they're not buying as much copper as they used to, and that has a knock-on effect, obviously, in Chile, because it creates a different kind of economic reality that affects, in particular, vulnerable subcontractors who do a lot of the work to make Codelco's operations happen.
Yeah, you know, that this is kind of it can be a teaching moment, the way you've seen, like, sanctions, for example, work in Russia, or just a variety of different things, you know, adapting to volatile markets with the diversification of the economy, which should take place anyway. They're certainly better poised to handle it with the ongoing integration of the region than they would be if that weren't happening.
Right. Right. So then, the other thing we were talking about last week that is still very much in the news and is going to stay in the news for years is the continuing dispute between Venezuela and Guyana over their inherited territorial conflict from the colonial era, when we've talked about this before, and there's an area called Essequibo in the western part of Guyana, which is a huge territorial extension that has historically always been claimed by Venezuela for the last, getting on for 200 years, right, ever since Venezuelan independence.
Right.
And that territorial dispute is subject to a negotiating framework established in the 1960s. And now what's happened is that Guyana seems to have violated that agreement by offering exploration and exploitation concessions to ExxonMobil in that area, which is actually disputed by Venezuela. So Venezuela's in trying to get a process going in the United Nations to enable a successful negotiation over the dispute with Guyana. And Guyana's response seems to be that they'd prefer to take the dispute to the International Court of Justice in The Hague. So we'll see how that plays out. But it's very clear that there's some mischief-making going on there, certainly by ExxonMobil and probably supported by the U.S. government.
Yeah, you know, we're only like a month and a half away from the opening of the UN General Assembly for the year, and I wonder if we're going to be hearing about that and Malvinas and some of the other ongoing disputes this year at the General Assembly.
Yeah, I'm sure that'll be the case. I mean, there's the apart from the dispute between Venezuela and Guyana, there are other territorial disputes, for example, between Nicaragua and Costa Rica, between Bolivia and Chile, the most important one, apart from the dispute between Guyana and Venezuela, which has the potential to be very destructive of regional integration processes. The other main dispute is that between Bolivia and Chile, which is over Bolivia's historic claim ever since the 19th century to a sovereign maritime route to the sea, through territory that was taken over by military conquest by Chile back in a war in something like 1873, I think it was.
Yeah.
So there's that going on, and that's certainly going to figure in the discussions in the UN General Assembly later this year.
I saw something on that within the last day or two that looked kind of hopeful, actually. I don't remember if I saw that Telesur or somewhere, but it seems like there was suddenly a willingness to have a discussion about a specific proposal that I think that Evo Morales has, and that Chile somehow responded in a way that, you know, showed some interest in discussing it.
Yeah, and Bolivia has suggested to Chile that they actually renew diplomatic relations because their relations have been maintained at consular level, below the full ambassador level, for decades. I can't remember since when, since the early 19th century, so the early 20th century, I think.
Really?
And so what Evo Morales has said, he's proposed restoring relations to full diplomatic relations to ambassador level. And but what he's saying is that he's proposing that Pope Francis be the mediator in that dispute. And Chile's saying, well, we don't want any kinds of conditions. We're open to re-establishing full diplomatic relations, but we don't want any kinds of conditions. And so, that's another process that's going to take many months and probably years to work out.
Well, you know, I get nervous whenever anybody talks about a pope drawing boundary lines in Latin America. It didn't work out so well last time. But there is a different dynamic. This particular pope does actually come from Latin America, so maybe that'll
help. Yeah, he's from Argentina, so. And he's very much regarded as he's very highly regarded by all sectors of opinion but most sectors of opinion in Latin America and the Caribbean.
Right.
So what else has been going on? There's other stuff going on that President Juan Manuel Santos in Colombia has been making helpful moves. I think he's ordered the military to suspend bombing operations against the FARC guerrilla with whom he's negotiating in Havana, Cuba, the peace process. But at the same time, there's unhelpful things going on. For example, the public prosecutor's office, I think it was yesterday, announced that they were going to table possible prosecutions against individual members of the FARC guerrilla for alleged war crimes. So that's not helpful.
Right.
There's a constant tug of war going on within the Colombian political establishment over the peace process. There's a lot of optimism that there may be a definitive peace agreement this year. But let's see. We'll see how things pan out over the next couple of months, won't we?
Yeah, that would be very helpful, though, that solving that particular.
And that is a civil war that's been going on for 60 years.
Yeah, a long time.
And so, you know, it'd be a huge step forward for the region if Colombia can, and a huge political feather in the cap for Santos.
Oh, for sure.
If he can resolve that, and he's well aware of that.
And it would also an effective repudiation of Uribe and that entire trend in the region.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
So then, and other things going on here in the region in Central America, and there's a transport strike that's been going on for about a week now in El Salvador. I mean, it's a very strange kind of strike. The gangs, the organized crime gangs, in El Salvador called the Mara, and also in Honduras, they kind of intimidated bus owners in San Salvador, in the capital, more intimidating them so that they take their buses off the streets and effectively shut down public transport in San Salvador.
I thought you were going to say the mafia went on strike.
Far from it. And so the government's reacted, and also the right wing Arena Party has probably done itself no favors by trying to exploit that.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.